From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court in a 6-3 ruling on Thursday affirmed that former felons in Florida will not have the right to vote if they've not paid off all fines related to their incarceration. Florida residents had passed a ballot measure to allow voting in this demographic, but Republican state lawmakers stopped its implementation as just one of many ways in which the Conservative Party has worked to block voting. Now, as the nation struggles with an exploding coronavirus pandemic, many fear that in spite of low poll numbers, President Donald Trump could eke out a win in November if not enough voters turn out. Joining me to tell us all about the Progressive Turnout Project is the executive director of the organization, Alex Morgan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Let's first reflect on what the Supreme Court has just voted on. This was a ruling on Thursday. This is a very interesting case where voters of a state essentially affirmed the right of felons to be able to vote. And of course, this is a demographic that is disproportionately people of color just because of the racism built into our criminal justice system. And now state lawmakers have won when the Supreme Court affirmed it. Do you see this as a voter suppression tactic?
Absolutely. This has been an uphill battle for so long. You know, all through the 2018 election, there was a real effort to get this on the ballot and ensure that folks got their right to vote restored so that they could, you know, participate fully in our democracy. And ever since it passed, and it had to meet a very high threshold is another thing to point out. But as soon as it passed, you know, Governor DeSantis, the Republicans in the legislature have fought tooth and nail to gut the law and ensure that folks aren't able to cast their ballot in what's going to be a really crucial election year.
And of course, we have many, many other ways in which the Republican Party has openly worked to block voting at the state level. They've made overall these huge claims about voter fraud, which study after study shows isn't a thing. And President Trump has blamed illegal voting. He's even claimed that that's why he lost the popular vote in 2016. So there's a huge number of efforts and attacks from various directions that have blocked the ability to vote. Is it fair to say that when voter turnout is high, Democrats tend to benefit?
I think there's a lot of, there's some truth to that, right? When more people participate, I think that, you know, they're resoundingly supporting policies that are good for everybody. And I would just happen to say Democrats tend to support those more than our Republican counterparts. But when we're talking about this myth around, illegal voter registrations, right? Voter ID laws, voter fraud. Fraud with vote by mail is something the president has been talking about an awful lot lately. There's no evidence that that really is happening at a persistent level in any state. And then B, we actually find that there are a significant number of Republicans who choose to participate, in voting by mail or other methods as well. So
Trump himself has voted by mail.
This is hurting, exactly. President Trump, his staff have voted by mail. So they actually are, I think, hurting themselves in the long run, but they're doing anything that they can to cling to power right now in this very short-sighted vision, thinking that if they retain control of governorships and state legislatures as we go into a new decade, right, they'll control redistricting, which really is the whole rules of the game for 10 more years. So they're doing everything they can to keep folks away from the polls so that they can cling to power for another decade. And we're doing everything that we can to get folks out to vote and boost voter turnout so that folks have their voices heard and have a representative democracy in a new decade.
So let's talk about what those efforts are. There are so many challenges this year. In a year when the stakes might not be higher, you know, where the election that we face in November is likely the most important election of our lives. Not only do we have all of those myriad efforts at blocking voters from being able to cast their ballots, we have a very deadly and contagious virus. And we have a president who we know doesn't feel bound by ethics, by rules, or by laws. How does one turn out voters in such an election year? And of course, we've had many primary elections just this year alone that some see as, you know, a sort of test of turnout in November.
It's incredibly challenging because, as you just pointed out, the rules are changing constantly, right? Throughout the primary elections, we've seen the number of polling places stripped down to, you know, a handful or even single polling places in some communities. We see record numbers of vote by mail requests, which, while great, are overwhelming underfunded boards of elections that don't know how to handle the overwhelming number that's coming their way. And we've seen, you know, challenges just like we do on election day. There are the same challenges posed to early voting periods as well. So this year is more important than ever in terms of the election and also in terms of getting out the vote. And we know that, and what we focus on at Progressive Turnout Project is face-to-face voter interactions because our studies have shown that we've been able to get folks out to vote by 10.4 additional percent when we have a conversation with them at their doorstep. So for the past 3.5 months, we've been really thinking about how do we do this really important, this really meaningful, this really effective work in the midst of everything that is going on. And we've been consulting with a medical expert to think about how do you do this safely and still go into a community and get to folks' doors and have that important conversation. So
now we know that in the lead up to Barack Obama's first election, there was huge excitement, a lot of money raised online, digital means to whip up excitement about an election have been quite effective. It's also cheap. It's easy. A lot more and more people are tuned in to social media platforms. But you're saying that old-fashioned doorstep conversation with voters is actually more effective? I mean, that's quite remarkable. I mean, I know that when someone knocks on my door, if it's a stranger, I just don't want to answer the door.
Well, that's true for a lot of people, for sure. But it's those conversations where we break through, where we have an incredible impact. You are right that digital advertising and engagement is really cheap and easy. And we're going to see an unprecedented amount of spending there by the Trump and Biden campaigns. What we find in our work, though, and we've done our own digital advocacy trials and found that it boosts voter turnout about 1%. But it's our on-the-ground efforts that have boosted turnout 10.4%. And we're investing early in talking with voters who the party doesn't always get to until really close to election day, and who I'm really concerned if we're not running field programs, period, are we going to reach through any other medium? So we're looking at knocking about 10 million doors this year. Wow. Half of our target voters are voters of color, half are under 35, and about half of them in total stayed home in 2016. So we're talking about really important folks in our country who can make the difference come November.
We know that in 2016, there was a low voter enthusiasm for probably both candidates, but especially, unfortunately, for the Democratic candidate. And then we saw in the primary elections earlier this year, the huge youth voter enthusiasm around the candidacy of Bernie Sanders appears to not have actually materialized when push came to shove. So what are some of the conversations that you have with people or that your volunteers and workers have with folks on their doorsteps about why it's worth it? And of course, the political landscape is quite different these days, with especially the massive death toll that's continuing to rise from the coronavirus. It's possible that Americans might be feeling more motivated to show up to vote.
Absolutely. We actually find that talking about issues and not the candidates so much is much more effective in terms of engaging this type of inconsistent Democratic voter, as we might call them. We go to their door early and we make multiple passes, you know, over the course of the year. It was our goal to launch our program in May. Obviously, that did not happen, but we started getting programs up and running in mid to late June. And what we're doing between now and Labor Day is doing an initial survey of our voters and asking them what issues that they care about. And then we'll come back after Labor Day to talk more with them about connecting that issue to the ballot box and making sure that they, you know whether it's voting by mail or early voting or going to the polls on Election Day, that they have a plan for getting to the polls. What's really interesting is in our early conversations with voters, in addition to the pandemic, which has been on everyone's minds, we're seeing a significant number of folks, about 20%, who are telling us that police brutality, racial justice, and racial equity are their top issue right now, which is something really unprecedented. And we're really enjoying engaging in these conversations with voters about how they can make a difference in their community, both, you know, at the ballot box and in what they're doing with their day-to-day lives.
Do you find that there's a lot of confusion around how people are going to be able to vote this November? I mean, every state has their own rules, some of which are then changing. They're being adjusted to fit the pandemic. There's, you know, absentee ballots, mail-in ballots, there's provisional ballots, and then there's in-person voting, which may or may not happen in your precinct. Maybe you have fewer polling places because of the pandemic than you did before. I imagine that there is a pretty serious, labyrinth to navigate for voters looking to cast their ballots in November.
That's going to be a big part of the conversation this year. The first word you used when talking about methods of voting was absentee, which is a term that I think a lot of people hear and they say, oh, I need an excuse to vote by mail, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to do a lot of work in states that have expanded that ballot access over the past few years to help folks understand that you don't need a particular reason for why you need to vote by mail other than you just want to vote by mail. And we see that in key battleground states. Both Michigan and Pennsylvania removed the excuse from their vote by mail request process for the first time this presidential election. And actually in both those states, you can sign up online. So something we've been doing is directing folks to those Secretary of State websites so that they can go online right away and request their ballot for the fall.
And then there's also the issue of trust, right? There are people who don't trust that their votes will be counted if they mail them. And there are people who don't trust that voting machines, in-person voting at voting machines may not properly record their vote or may have their vote switched. It's a huge problem these days in so many arenas. For example, when it comes to public health and the coronavirus, misinformation has muddied the waters. And the same, I imagine, is true around voting, one's right to vote, one's access to vote.
Unfortunately, you know, that is true. There is so much misinformation out there, as well as folks who are, you know, as we talked about at the top of the conversation, actively trying to suppress the vote, through a variety of ways. And so, you know, we're thankful to our all the folks who are in the courtroom fighting, fighting back against these voter suppression tactics to try and make sure that the vote is as accessible as possible this November and well into the future. But, you know, that's exactly what feeds into folks' mistrust about the process, which is, again, why we work so hard to start this conversation with voters as early as possible, right, so that we can dispel those notions and get to the heart of what our voters care about. And remind them that it's worth it to put in the effort to cast that vote.
So the effort that your organization, Progressive Turnout Project, has launched, I understand it's the earliest such effort. We're here in July, the election's in November, and that early access gets people thinking about voting. Tell me where or in which cities your organization has launched this program, where you're going to be expanding. I imagine you're going to be looking to either hire people or recruit volunteers?
We work mostly with full-time paid staff who are out there knocking on doors pretty much all day, every day. And we're looking to get up to a little over 1,100 full-time field staff who are across 17 different battleground states. We're investing a grand total of $52.5 million into this effort. We really want to win this year. And we're in a lot of states that you would think of, right? Key presidential battleground states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, as well as key Senate states, because we know that just having a Democratic president is not going to be enough. So, there are competitive races in Colorado and Maine, where we have Susan Collins on the ballot this year, and North Carolina, among others. So, these are really important races at a variety of levels of the ballot. And we find that by focusing on issues first, we're actually, turning out folks who are likely to vote for Democrats up and down their ballot. So this will end up including folks who are running for state legislatures or running for, district attorney or prosecutor positions that play a crucial role in their communities. So if we can activate these voters, it's not just the flipping the White House and defeating Donald Trump, although that is the number one objective this cycle. It's about really making sure folks' voices are heard at all levels, and that ends up being reflected, in city halls and state houses and of course, Washington, D.C.
And so let's talk about what you alluded to earlier, which is that you have to sort of figure out a safe way to do this, right? So I'm assuming all your workers will be wearing masks. You can't ensure that the people whose doors you're knocking on will be wearing masks. In fact, they probably won't, because they'll be at home. But I assume there'll be a socially distanced conversation taking place.
Right. Yes, we have thought through, our process from start to finish. If you've ever been, in a campaign office before, it's where you go to get trained. It's really exciting. You get pumped up. You might have a donut if it's early in the morning or catch some pizza late at night. But unfortunately, our offices are not a thing this year. Zoom is our office this year. So all of our trainings are done remotely. Our staff are going right to their turf. We've always issued staff iPads because it's easier from a data entry standpoint. And so we were automatically equipped from a technological standpoint. But so they receive their assignments for the day on their iPad. They have masks for every day of the week, because we know that masks and social distancing are, the best things that we can be doing to prevent the spread of the disease, but also, protect our canvassers as well. They do approach the house to knock on the door, but then they are stepping way back at least 6 feet to make sure that conversation happens at an appropriate distance.
Right.
We're keeping track of our conversations and thinking about, who doesn't want to be contacted this year, and making sure that we remove them from our universe. It's a very interesting time, but we're finding that most folks, see that mask and understand that, that's us paying a certain level of respect to them, and knowing that we're putting public health first. And so we're actually having a lot of really good conversations. You're right that not every voter is wearing a mask, but if you go to our Twitter account, at Turnout Pack, you'll see lots of really great pictures from the field. And you see the little crinkles around the eyes of folks who are smiling, but their smile is behind a mask with their commit to vote card.
I imagine that during this time of social isolation in many places, a conversation with a real person might even be welcome, even if they're someone you've never met before. I also want to end our conversation taking a look at how the attacks on our U.S. Postal Service are also, unfortunately, a form of voter suppression. So say you do get enough people to turn out to vote, you get enthusiastic voters, they are relying on sending in their ballots by mail because they may not feel comfortable voting in person. Trump has already claimed that voting by mail is something that he intends to target. And now we know that the new chief of the new director of the U.S. Postal Service that Trump has appointed has informed the USPS to deliberately slow down delivery, you know, which you just wonder, is that linked to voter turnout or voter, you know, is this an attempt at voter suppression?
You know, we know Donald Trump has had this weird, grudge with the Postal Service that I think even predates this election. You know, he brings it up in talking about Amazon packages and all these other things. But I think it certainly has something to do with voting. He has been on this topic, you know, for the past, since he's been elected, right? He talked about ballots still coming in from California and how can that be possible so many days after election day, as though he doesn't understand how the mail works, which maybe he doesn't. But we certainly know that funding of the Postal Service is a major issue, and what is going to happen if the Postal Service is underfunded this year. The other thing that the USPS just put out was a pretty comprehensive report of all the issues that arose from the Wisconsin Supreme Court and primary election back in April. And they pointed out the fact that there are a good number of states that allow folks to request vote-by-mail ballots up until just a day or two before Election Day. And they said, you know, it takes us time to both deliver that ballot to the voter and deliver that back to the Board of Elections. So you need to consider, you know, either when your deadline is, or allow folks more time after Election Day to get that ballot back to the Board of Elections, because, you know, they said it may take us a week to, you know, get that full turnaround time. So the slowing of the Postal Service is a serious issue. The funding of the Postal Service is a serious issue. And so I encourage anyone who's listening right now who plans to vote by mail, think about what that process is for your state. If you can request your ballot online right now, please go and do it so that that request is queued up as soon as your Board of Elections or your Secretary of State goes to start sending out ballots, as we get into September and October.
Right. Alex, give out the website for Progressive Turnout Project so people can find out more about the work you do.
Absolutely. So all about our project is at turnoutpac.org. PAC.org. We also have a ton of voter information at votingmatters.org, where you can find that key information about how to sign up to vote by mail and what those current deadlines may be. So please check us out, and thank you for talking with me today.
And we'll post a link to that from our website as well. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alex Morgan is Executive Director of the Progressive Turnout Project. We've been discussing voter turnout in the age of coronavirus and Donald Trump. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.